Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Freemasonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. I'm your host, Brother Robert Johnson. This is episode 157. If this is your first time listening, I'd like to welcome you to the show. If you are a returning listener, thanks for coming back. The news for this week, not too much going on in the news that I have read about. It's not really a piece per se, but the first thing I wanted to go into was a really neat story that I did receive in a private message from a gentleman who was an entered apprentice, and I asked him if I could share his story because I just thought it was so unique. So I'll just read it to you. It's from JJ Wasco. It just says, "Good morning, Brother Johnson. I began listening to your Whence Came You podcast back in May. I started listening as an uninitiated candidate for Freemasonry. I had already petitioned my local lodge, and I was eagerly waiting for my petition to be accepted. My petition was voted on at the beginning of June, and it was accepted. I was very excited. On July 3rd, 2014, I was initiated into the craft of Freemasonry in Sharpsville, PA, Lodge number 517. My excitement level was and is now raised even higher. To make a long story short, I am an IBEW, journeyman, wireman, electrician. The IBEW, if you're unfamiliar with that, it's basically a union for electricians. It says, last week I started working on a job in Canton, Ohio, and I met a fellow brother. I noticed that he had a Masonic ring on, and that is what caused me to strike up a conversation with him. His ring being the subject of our initial conversation, he removed it from his finger and instructed me to put it on one of my fingers. It fit, my right pinky, but it still fit. He then told me to keep it, and when I had tried to explain that I was only an EA, he told me to take note of the square and compasses on that ring. It was an EA ring. I will wear the ring proudly until I can purchase my own Master Mason's ring. I will be passed to the degree of Fellowcraft on August 7th, 2014, and I can't wait. As long as everything goes well, I will have my Master Mason's degree conferred upon me on September 11th, 2014. And then what he did was he actually sent me a photograph of this ring, and it's an entered apprentice ring, and it was really neat. And he says that, "I think it's truly awesome and a great testament to the brotherhood. I was instructed to pass it along to a newly initiated EA when I became a Master Mason, and I meet one on a job. This is how our brother received this ring as well." So I just want to say thanks to that brother for sharing the story. It's very inspirational, and I think it is a way to almost be a mentor without being a mentor. It's just really an interesting story to see somebody hand over a ring like that and just say, "Hey, this is yours now. You do the same." Very cool, really cool tradition. I don't know how some people feel about anybody wearing Masonic regalia before their Master Mason, but if it is an EA ring, why not? If you don't agree, hit me up on Facebook. Let me know why. And I also wanted to share a quick update about J.J. Wasco. On August 7th, he was passed to the degree of Fellowcraft. So I just want to say congrats to you, brother, and I know you're going to do really well. So the second piece that I have for you in this episode is the second part of James E. Fry's Rosicrucians in the Royal Arch. Now, if you missed last week, you're going to want to go back and listen to that, or all three parts to this are actually out. And they're on the Midnight Freemasons, so you can check it out over there at midnightfreemasons.org. But without further ado, I will go ahead with this paper, Rosicrucians in the Royal Arch, Part 2. In 1614, Wilhelm Wessel printed a very strange document which got circulated around Germany. This document was called Fama Fraternitatis, or A Discovery of the Fraternity of the Most Noble Order of the Rose Cross. This pamphlet contained the legend of the founder of the order of the German monk named Christian Rosenkreutz. According to the legend, Rosenkreutz was a pious German scholar who wanted to learn the mysteries, so he ventured on a pilgrimage to Damascus where he studied alchemy and magic. Then he traveled to a mysterious city, Damkar, in Arabia, then into Egypt where he studied hermetics, and then into Morocco and Fez, and up through Spain and back into Germany. Upon his return, he founded a study group to teach all that he had learned, which were called the Rosicrucians. The legend ends with the death of Christian Rosenkreutz and his followers building him a secret vault with seven sides to deposit his body. It is said that each of the walls had a variety of cryptic occult symbols that surrounded the body, above which was placed an ever-burning light. The 106 years later, his followers opened the tomb as directed and discovered the body had not decayed, still grasping his secret book. They then took the book and each went their own way to spread the secrets, all taking vows to heal the sick and afflicted, only using their powers to help humanity. So a variety of these pamphlets, such as the Confessio and the Chemical Wedding of a Christian Rosencreutz, began to circulate, and this legend to replace Hermes as the pagan teacher with Christian Rosencreutz, who was a Christian and would be acceptable in the new Reformed environment. This Christianized Hermeticism and Kabbalah spread around Western Europe and became somewhat of a folk story, gaining cultural momentum in academic circles. There was no clear evidence to show that Rosicrucians themselves ever existed, but the Rosicrucian manifestos helped to promote the study of Christian esoteric thought, in which influenced some of the most influential thinkers in society, and even, from its inception, Freemasonry. Well, the first connection of Rosicrucianism and Freemasonry is found in a poem published in Edinburgh in 1638, quote, "For what we do presage in not in gross, for we be brethren of the rosy cross. We have the Mason word and second sight, things for to come we can foretell aright," end quote. Regis poem, 1638. The Regis is important because the poem marks the transition of the operative stonemason guilds into the speculative craft. The first speculative mason initiated was Robert Moray in Edinburgh Lodge on May 20th, 1641. Moray was influential in founding the Royal Society in England. Moray was deeply interested in alchemy and chemistry, as were many members of the Royal Society. Elias Ashmole, who received his initiation into the Masonic Lodge in Washington in Lancashire on October 16th, 1646. As more members of the Royal Society began to gain entrance into the guilds, the climate and philosophical tone of the craft began to change. Elias Ashmole was influenced into this cultural shift because he himself was an avid Rosicrucian scholar. Ashmole translated the Fama and Confessio into English by hand introducing the Rosicrucian manifestos into England. Upon publishing these works, Ashmole also added a letter to the Rosicrucians proclaiming admiration for their teachings and desiring admission into their society. Other members of the Royal Society were also greatly influenced by Rosicrucianism. John Wilkins, in his book Mathematical Magic, 1648, quotes the Fama, and Francis Bacon uses the Rosicrucians as inspiration of his Merchants of Light in New Atlantis. So we can see the correlation of Rosicrucianism influence on the Royal Society as its members developed and reshaped Freemasonry into a speculative craft. All right, so again, that is from the Midnight Freemasons series, Rosicrucians in the Royal Arch. And the whole series is up on the Midnight Freemasons website, which is midnightfreemasons.org, and you can find it there. You just kind of scroll back, or you can search using the search tool on the blog. But all three parts are there, and next week we will finish it up by reading part three. So at this time, I'd ask you to support the show by purchasing the show apps, which are on Windows 8, Android, or Apple. The app lets you listen streaming. It also gives you access to the papers that we read via PDF and gives you access to a Masonic-themed wallpaper for your mobile device. You can also donate to the show via PayPal. There are a few books from the Whence Came You bookstore that if you purchase, $1 of the book sale goes back to the show. And of course, we have a couple affiliates, the first being Onnit Labs. If you go to onnit.com and you buy some really cool healthy living supplements, you can use the promo code WCY and you will get 10% off, and a little bit comes back to this show to help keep the lights on. Same thing with freemasonryart.com. Anything you buy there, use the code WCY at checkout and you'll get 10% off. Freemasonryart.com just happens to have a brand new print that was put out by Brother Juan Sepulveda, and it's only $20, and it's really cool. It's a perfect gift for the past master in your life, whether that is the current master and he's going out and you want to give it as a gift from your officers to your worshipful master. I think it's a great idea and it's a really nice print. You should definitely check it out. In fact, if you want to take a look at it, just head on over to freemasonryart.com. You may have seen it last week on the Masonic Roundtable when Brother Juan showed us the new print. All right, so before we go any further in this week's episode, I did want to say that I need to address a misconception by a couple of brothers who are pretty good guys, and I think they think that I don't like them. If you know what I'm talking about, okay, but I'm not going to say anything else. I'm just going to say there are some guys, some brothers who have a podcast, and I listened to their episode where they had a special guest, Brother Tech, who is a friend of mine, and he was on there to talk about the new book, A Christian's Perspective on Masonic Symbols, The Square and Compasses. And during their interview and before their interview, they kind of joked that maybe there was another podcaster out there who had an educational podcast that maybe didn't like them or had ill feelings toward them. And I need to assure you guys that I have no ill will or any bad feelings about your podcast or you guys in general. I think what you guys are doing is awesome. You have a great niche, and I'd love to work with you guys at some point. And I also was talking with Brother Juan Sepulveda, and he feels the same way I do. So no ill will or bad feelings toward you guys. And we thought that the interview you guys did with Brother Tech was outstanding. So keep on keeping on, and give me a shout sometime if you guys need help with anything. And now I wanted to address something I totally forgot to talk about in the news, which is a new project that Brother Bill Hosler and I started working on. We kind of brainstormed a little bit. And if you remember some episodes back, we talked about old-time radio. And we even played an old-time radio program right here on the show. We broke it into sections. And we did 5 to 10 minute sections each week until we had the whole episode laid out. And it was an old time radio drama, and it had a Masonic twist to it, which was really neat. And the response to that was pretty good. So we thought, you know, Brother Bill Hosler has such a good imagination and writes some great Masonic fiction. What can we do to use that and make our own Masonic radio drama? So we have a script. Brother Bill wrote a great script. The first episode is going to be called The Craftsman, and we have a great cast coming up. Many of the Midnight Freemasons are going to be doing the voices for the show. Hopefully they accept my invitation to do the voiceover work. You'll be hearing myself as well as Brother Bill Hosler, Brother Brian Shimian, and even my wife is going to do a part in that. So it should be pretty fun. And I really hope you guys like it. And if it takes off, it will be another podcast altogether. I will go ahead and produce a second show, which will be just the Masonic dramas. And even if they don't take off as well as I hope they do, I will have them on this show every once in a while. As we complete them, they'll go up. So keep that in mind. And without further ado, I'm going to go right into our third piece, which is called Ritual in Freemasonry. Ritual in Freemasonry. Probably nothing has so mystified Mason and non-Mason alike as the concept of Masonic ritual. To some non-Masons, it is an intriguing mystery deserving a surreptitious search so as to discover the innermost secrets of Freemasonry, to the extent to which some non-Masonic witch hunters have gone to discover and reveal the true meaning of Masonic ritual is worthy of a separate paper. For the purpose of this paper, however, suffice it to observe that Masonic ritual has an uncommon fascination both within the Masonic order and without. Let us examine ritual as we see it in Freemasonry. First, let us determine the true purpose of ritual. The most obvious point to be discovered in a study of any ritual is that it is a teaching system by which a student may be taught, and when the student has learned, the student may then become a teacher, always with a constant result as the objective. Rituals are not the exclusive domain of Freemasonry. Any institution, whether religious, military, governmental, social, or fraternal, may and does use forms of ritual to relate to former events, to maintain continuity with former times, to teach, but above all, to unify. The overriding benefit of ritual is that it is a prescribed form of activity which at once unifies the participant and the observer. A religious liturgy is a suitable example of the unification of participant and observer. The participants and observers, being aware of the prescribed form, are unified in the activity from previous experiences with the written ritual. Ritual provides an intellectual link between participant and observer. In fact, our use of ritual is so intellectually involving that the only observer to Masonic ritual is the candidate, since all others are either active or passive participants. Hence, ritual is, or ought to be, a unifying experience. I said ritual ought to be a unifying experience, which must indicate there are times when it is not. When then might it not be unifying? On occasion that comes readily to mind is when a person selected to perform some of the work demonstrates a disrespectful lack of preparation. In the pursuit of his allotted task, the brother extemporizes to make his way through his assignment. The results are manifold. Firstly, the candidate has received something less than that for which he paid. The extemporized work may have conjured in the mind of the candidate a faulty perception of the lesson being taught. These are minor examples of how incorrectly presented ritual deviates from its intent. In time, the candidate will hopefully have a sufficient exposure to correctly presented ritual, that he will fully understand the essential message, yet some of the desirable effects of ritual are lost. For example, lost for all time is the opportunity to make a proper first impression. Equally important, we have not delivered to the candidate the very best degree to which he was entitled, nor have we given the candidate a rebate for a faulty degree. Also lost in that sense of unity, or as I previously described, intellectual unification, extemporaneous ad libs, fabrications, or any failure which is evidence or lack of preparation causes those following the work to become mentally separated from the work. Their thoughts move now to more mundane concerns. Some of those concerns might be wondering why more preparation was not exercised. We might be moved to think we could have done so much better. We might wonder why the presenter had not requested our assistance. In some cases, we might find some of the members making mental notes to take the erring ritualist to task. Whatever the change in mental attitude, it is clear that there has been a cleavage introduced between the presenter of the ritualistic work and those who have been following. The followers have been sidetracked from the uplifting unification ceremonies in which they were attuned to mundane and lackluster negative thoughts. Having said all this, let us keep in mind that ritual is a compilation of prescribed thoughts, words, and actions. It is deserving of the most careful preparation and attention to detail. Any expeditious departures destroys the ritualistic journey we had embarked upon with all present and bring us into just another room with other people who become aware of the lack of preparedness. Obviously, what I have been trying to outline is the superhuman effort in perfection, without dwelling too long on the fact that we are all merely human and therefore do fall occasionally a little short of perfection. We must nevertheless never allow lack of preparation to be an excuse for human imperfection. Because we are human, we must also examine the human side of a well-prepared ritualist. What, if any, is the difference between an error caused by nerves, distractions, excitement, emotion, and those caused by lack of preparation? To the observer, the difference is readily apparent, and the result is significantly different. Errors by a well-prepared ritualist awaken feelings of understanding and compassion. When an honest error occurs, either by stress or distraction, the thought process of the observer and participants are positive thoughts, whereby the central concern is one of wondering how to help rather than rebuke. The orientation of the concern has a completely different thrust. Lack of preparation evokes critical negative thoughts, thoughts of chastisement or castigation. Errors which are evinced as due to stress evoke positive supportive thoughts. Surely then, in full cognizance of our human imperfections, we should so prepare ourselves that when we err, it will never be due to lack of preparation. It may be said then that ritual, as we know it and use it, has an inherent ability to exploit our human foibles to promote brotherhood or destroy it. We can come to this conclusion here without even discussing any specific working, be it in the ancient York Rite ritual or the emulation ritual. What we have outlined is that generic term ritual, regardless of the form it takes or the specific words, actions, or symbols used in its presentation. That leads some of our votaries to state that the specifics in a ritual are not as important as the thoughts we are trying to portray. It is precisely that impression that leads to the lack of preparedness I have been trying to highlight. Of course, the words as set down are important. It matters not one whit if the words, actions, etc. are different under different workings or rites. It does not matter that words, actions, etc. contained within a specific ritual be adhered to as closely as humanly possible. We already know the Masonic legends are essentially the same within all regular Grand Lodges and regular Masonic workings. It follows then that while our ritual may not be the same as other rituals, our lodge, whichever lodge it may be, has been authorized to use a specific form of ritual, and none other. It is that specific ritual that binds us into a brotherhood with all others that have preceded us in the lodge, as well as those who will follow us. On that premise, we conclude that our ritual is deserving of the very best and near-perfect rendition any one of us is called upon to perform. It may therefore be said correctly that reasonable, rational Masons find that Masonic rituals are an important link in the Brotherhood process. We must nonetheless understand that quite the opposite effect may result when a Masonic ritual is treated as the end-all and be-all of Freemasonry. When we allow our perception of Freemasonry to be centered on the ritual rather than the lessons taught by the ritual, we misread its essential characteristic. Far too often, we find what we might term ritual vultures. These are Masons whose only purpose it is to go to Masonic meetings, whether in the lodge or elsewhere, for the sole pleasure of pointing out the errors of others. Sometimes it is necessary for these birds of prey to strain every fiber of their being to find a fault. Yet, find a fault they do. Faults which are essentially of no consequence, and which are recognized by all as caused by a momentary distraction. Our birds of prey do one of two things. A. To show their superior knowledge, they immediately provide an audible correction for all to hear, and so distract the brother doing the work, as well as the candidate. The lodge room is suddenly filled with all manner of dissimilar and uninspiring thoughts. Or B. The bird of prey enters into a state of excitement. He can hardly contain his pleasure that he will shortly have the opportunity to destroy any feeling of accomplishment enjoyed by the brother who performed the work, a sad case of ritual becoming more important than the lessons the ritual presents. To summarize, let us understand that Masonic ritual is an important element of our craft, and one deserving of flawless presentation. Let us also understand, however, that we are all capable of error. When we are compelled to draw attention to some apparent departure from the proper form, the occasion should be used as a vehicle to promote brotherhood. This means that, except for the corrections made in rehearsals, all other corrections should be done in private and in the supportive manner so that the erring brother senses a feeling of kind assistance rather than unyielding criticism. Let us accept the fact that Masonic ritual should never be used as a means to embarrass anyone. Masonic ritual is an excellent method to develop poise and composure when addressing groups. One who has overcome the tensions of rendering a portion of the ritual where every word is known by most listeners has the ability to speak at ease to a group of listeners who do not know what words are to be used. Even if it is necessary for a brother to be prompted on each word for valid reasons other than lack of preparation, he should be able to experience the marvelous feeling of support flowing to him as he makes his way through the part, as all others have done before him. Help the ritualist grow in poise, composure, and intellect, then surround him with fraternal love and affection, for he will then be your brother. Such is an integral part of Masonic ritual. All right, let's get into this week's famous Freemason. Brother Roger Kidder, born 1950, is a British actor, best known for playing Captain Alberto Bertarelli in Season 7 of the British sitcom TV series LOLO. With Kaplan K, he also recorded a song, Chalk Dusk, The Umpire Strikes Back, using the moniker The Brat. He released it on the Hansa label. It entered the UK singles chart on the 10th of July 1982. It reached a peak of number 19 and remained in the chart for 8 weeks. The song was a top 10 hit in the Netherlands, Belgium, and South Africa, and lampooned John McEnroe complaining about line calls in tennis. Quote, "The ball's in, everyone can see that the ball's in," end quote. He is also an impressionist who provided the voice of Tommy Cooper in the Lego Kipper advertisement. As a Freemason, he is a member of the Chelsea Lodge number 3098, made up of entertainers. On the 25th of September 2009, he became the chairman of the Entertainment Artists Benevolent Fund. That's it for this week. Please remember to find us on Facebook and follow on Twitter. Check us out on Google Plus at the email address wcypodcast@gmail.com. You can also address any correspondences to that same email. I'd like to ask you guys to please check out the Midnight Freemasons. We publish 3 times a week, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. You can find that at www.midnightfreemasons.org. That's .org. Additionally, we also have another show that's out on Tuesday nights. It features panelists from around the world, Masons who get together on the level on a show. It's much like The View, but it's with Masons and Masonic topics. It's called the Masonic Roundtable. That is, of course, as I said, Tuesday nights at 10, 9 Central. It's live and syndicated on YouTube and on iTunes as an audio only Or again, like I said, you can check it out on YouTube and it's video. If you find yourself needing some neckwear, please check out Fraternal Ties at fraternalties.com. I know Brother John Paul Gomez is always putting out really cool new projects here and there, and you'll do yourself a world of favors if you sign up for his email list, because that's how you're going to get invited to purchase the ties and the t-shirts and all the really cool stuff that he comes out with and gives away. So again, please check out fraternalties.com. And until next week, guys, stay on the level. For whence came you? I'm Robert Johnson.